Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about funding that's being made available in Longmont for minority-owned small businesses who are struggling during the COVID-19 pandemic. The deadline to apply for the funding is this afternoon. Then there's a possibility that voters in the state will be asked to decide on a ballot measure that would ban late-term abortions. We'll hear from Dr. Warren Hearn, who is the founder of the Boulder Abortion Clinic and one of a handful of clinics in the country to carry out late-term abortions. After that, we'll hear how Global Green Grants Fund, which is based in Boulder, is supporting communities around the world, helping them to protect their ways of life and give them a say in the health of their food, water and resources. We'll speak with the new CEO of the organisation about the work that they're supporting during the COVID-19 pandemic. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, at 8:35 this morning, Frank Dabowski speaks with the new Chief of Police in Boulder, Maris Harold. That's on A Public Affair. Then at 9 o'clock, it's media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news on public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
The Aurora City Council is expected to approve a new police chief Monday night, in addition to considering a citywide ban on officers using chokeholds. The Sentinel reports that both of the long-awaited decisions are coming amidst heightened hostilities between Aurora police and protest leaders demanding criminal charges against officers and possibly firefighters in the August 2019 death of Elijah McClain. It's been 7 months since the former chief of police retired after a string of scandals. There are four finalists, including Interim Chief Vanessa Wilson and current Commander Marcus Dudley. The other two finalists include Alexander Jones with the Baltimore County Police and Avery Moore with the Dallas Police Department. The council will also consider whether to codify a citywide ban on police using chokeholds on suspects, as well as carotid holds that restrict blood flow to the brain. Meanwhile, the president of the Aurora Department's Maine Police Union said he is exploring possible criminal charges against the organizer of a protest at the Aurora Municipal Complex last weekend. Police Sergeant Mark Sears said he was concerned with comments made by Candace Bailey, a co-founder of the Frontline Party for Revolutionary Action, in front of Aurora Police Headquarters on July 24th. That was the day before two people were shot on I-225 and dozens of windows were broken at the courthouse during demonstrations. In response to the police union leader's statement, Bailey said, "If he wants to go there, we can go there," adding that she hasn't incited any violence, but instead has worked with the police to keep agitators away. Bailey was recently named to a new police community police task force. However, Sears, the police sergeant, was prevented from joining the entity. The police have arrested the man alleged to have shot at the Jeep that drove into the crowd during the demonstration, but they have not arrested the driver of the Jeep. Residents of the Stapleton neighborhood have chosen to rename the area Central Park. On Saturday, the local neighborhood organization announced the results of a final week of voting. Residents could also have chosen Skyview, but Central Park received 63% of the vote. The Denverite reports that for years, people have been advocating to remove the old name due to its connection to Benjamin F. Stapleton, a former Denver mayor who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. The new name comes from a massive park in the neighborhood that sits along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in far northeast Denver. State Senator Angela Williams, who lives in the neighborhood, spoke on Saturday after the announcement and said the neighborhood is saying it doesn't support racism or social injustices. Meanwhile, the governor has named the 12 members of the board that will look at names of public places and spaces and geographic features in Colorado. Three are from Boulder, including CU professors Patty Limerick and William Way, both historians, and Junie Joseph, a member of the Boulder City Council. The board will evaluate proposals to change the names of certain public places and make recommendations to the governor. The Daily Camera reports that Polis announced he was creating the board last month amid calls to change names of landmarks with racist or controversial names. A federal appeals court ruled on Friday that a man cannot be deported from the United States based on a drug conviction in Colorado. The case could have broad implications for immigrants who have been convicted of minor drug offenses. The Denver Post reports that Everett Johnson, a citizen of the Bahamas, who became a permanent resident of the U.S. more than 40 years ago, pleaded guilty to possessing a controlled substance in Colorado 4 years ago. The Department of Homeland Security and the Board of Immigration Appeals sought his removal from the U.S. However, the Court of Appeals ruled that the Colorado law used as a basis for deportation is overbroad. The attorney who represented Johnson said that the decision will help a lot of people who have minor drug convictions. A wildfire sparked by lightning spread across 1,500 acres north of Grand Junction yesterday. The fire is on federal property, and a spokesperson said that the fire was growing fast and was not controllable as it's been so dry. The Colorado Sun reports that the state currently is one of the drier parts of the country, and although conditions have improved somewhat in recent weeks, the long-term outlook is relatively grim. Nearly all of Colorado is experiencing drought, according to the latest data released by the U.S. Drought Monitor. This year's drought isn't the most severe of the past decade, but according to Richard Heim, the author of the Drought Monitor, it will take years and years of heavy rain to get back to normal. A year ago, Colorado was surprisingly moist, but conditions have deteriorated with relatively warm temperatures and high rates of evaporation. Heim added that people need to understand that drought is not just what's happening in the last couple of weeks, but it's the accumulation of dryness that has taken place over a long period of time. There's probably not much relief in sight today, as the weather will be sunny with possibility of a scattered thunderstorms this afternoon and highs in the upper 80s. A few of the storms along the I-25 corridor could produce hail and strong winds. Tomorrow, storms again possible afternoon and highs in the low 90s. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. A new report shows that more than half of Black-owned businesses in the US may not survive the COVID-19 pandemic. People of colour are being disproportionately impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, so are minority-owned businesses. Well, a fund in Longmont is seeking to support minority-owned small businesses that are struggling during the shutdown. Strongmont 2 aims to assist cultural minorities, business owners that belong to African American, Latinx, Middle Eastern, Native American and Pacific Island communities. Applications are due today by 5:30 p.m. and small minority-owned businesses are encouraged to apply. Bernice Garcia-Talez is part of the board of directors at the Latino Chamber of Commerce. She spoke with Rosanna Longo on how the committee who will be reviewing the applications belongs to minority communities and that they'll be applying a racial equity lens.
I will say racial equity lens because you need to understand where these businesses are coming from. The systems in where they have developed are different from the white communities. So we need to accommodate and understand their needs and their culture, because what is important for those businesses maybe is not important for other businesses. So we need to have this in our mindset when we're reviewing applications. And it's what we're seeing with all these movements nationally and globally, new calling from racial equity. So I give you an example that we say that the most impacted sectors in demographics are for COVID are African-Americans and Hispanic Latinos. Why is that? If you don't apply equity, you will just think like, oh, they don't take care. They are, you know, going to party and they are young people. They don't care about, you know, using a face mask. But when you apply equity lens, you understand that these communities, they either, whether they are like employed by essential businesses or they have an essential business. An essential business, people and communities, they are more exposed to the virus because they need to, you know, to work in the meat industry, in packing all these products, to be in the service center. And most of the communities doing that are from these frontline communities. And if you need to stop and think about it when you're going to make a statement or approve or review something about it. It's how I see equity.
What are the limitations you see for minority small business owners to apply to these kind of funds?
And I see that one of the barriers that sometimes minority businesses have is, you know, the time to capacitate themselves, you know, to learn all these financial statements, have a good relationships with the banks, the trust. I mean, there is a, you know, frontline communities, there is a lack of trust with some organizations and government, etc. So, and also it's immigrant communities that that they just came here to work, and sometimes they need to work on, you know, how to present themselves. And one thing that one Latino business told me is like, Bernice, you also need to remember that in the Latino culture, we don't like to show up, presumir. I mean, we keep it to ourselves. And in these applications, you need to sell yourself. You need to sell all the great things your business is doing. So that's why, as I said, when we review things or when we apply things, we have to think in these cultural backgrounds that these businesses may have. Because maybe in their culture, you know, showing up is a bad thing or a bad sign. So, yeah, is what I would say.
I think it's a great point, because humility is something that we are taught since we are very little, that we need to be humble and that we need to be obedient and respectful. And that is a quality. And many, many times here, we don't value those things, especially when it's a business. We kind of need to brag about what we are selling. You know, it doesn't look good, especially in the Latino community. I can testify to that. My grandmother always would say, mijita, you have to be educadita. You have to hold your ground and be respectful.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And because we have, you know, some restaurants in Longmont that people from Fort Collins, Colorado Springs, just come here to Longmont to visit this Latino business. So, they don't say it. They don't. It's something that's why the Latino Chamber is trying to help them. You know, there's something to get to consumers is to tell your story. So that's why all these new concepts and being in online and the e-commerce and are topics that the Latino Chamber will be supporting and helping businesses on that.
Berenice Tellez, thank you so much for joining us and telling us these details. If you would like to again mention, where can people go to get support? Or if somebody is listening to us and knows about a wonderful business that belongs to a minority and would like to get them the information so that they can either apply to these funds, but is there something else that people can get some support in this moment?
They can contact the Latino Chamber, and website is www.thelatinochamberco.org, or they can call the number 720-238-6799, and we can send them all the resources, the application. But if they want they can visit the Longmont Community Foundation, and they can just type Strongmont 2 and all the information will come out. And we're also working, you know, with the state, with Energize Colorado, to find ways we can still support businesses, because the Latino Chambers not only support Longmont, it supports the whole county. So, you know, sometimes businesses say, hey, we need stuff for Lafayette, for Louisville. So we're trying to search all those sources for them, not just in one city. But this time it's Longmont where we have the bulk of our businesses. So I hope to see a lot of applicants from Longmont, and I wish them luck, and we're here to help.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I have been talking with Berenice Garcia Tellez. She's from the Latino Chamber of Commerce, and we have been talking about the Strongmont number 2 funds to support small businesses, especially those that belong to minorities here in Boulder County. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longo.
And the deadline to apply for those funds is today at 5:30 p.m. And you can find out more about the application at longmontfoundation.org or email info@latinochamber.org. info@latinochamber.org. It is 8:18. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. This November, voters in the state will be asked to decide on a ballot measure that would ban late-term abortions. Initiative 120 seeks to ban abortions performed after the gestational age of the fetus reaches 22 weeks. There would be an exception if the life of the mother is in danger. Well, Dr. Warren Hearn is the founder of the Boulder Abortion Clinic. It's one of a handful of clinics in the country that perform late-term abortions.
Let's start with the announcements by the sponsors of this ballot initiative. Is their purpose is to close my office, to shut down Dr. Hearn, unquote. That's their purpose. Because in my office, I'm the only physician in Colorado who performs late abortions. Some late abortions are performed at the University Hospital. Of course, they would be affected. But I specialize in late abortion. I opened my practice in 1975, specializing in outpatient abortion services. I have developed various techniques for doing late abortion safely. We have a lot of requests for women who have terrible problems with their pregnancies for late abortion. In many cases, the woman finds that at a very late stage in pregnancy, there is some catastrophic fetal abnormality or genetic disorder, which cannot be detected earlier. And she needs to, she needs to end the pregnancy, or her life may be in immediate danger from a medical condition. She may have severe preeclampsia. She may have some other condition. She may have cancer. We have also many patients who have victims of sexual abuse and rape, incest, including young girls that are 12 or 13 years old. We had a patient recently who was a victim of sex trafficking who was 12 years old. And I think that these women desperately need this help. Many of them cannot get to our services until they're very late in pregnancy. The COVID epidemic is one of the things that's making it very difficult for people to get an early diagnosis or any diagnosis at all of a problem with the pregnancy. And so this is an extremely important service. I'm one of the few doctors in the world that do late abortions. And many of those physicians refer their patients to me when they have a difficult case that they can't take care of. But we see many patients that cannot be seen in other clinics. We have a very important service for these women who are desperate, and we're the only place that some of them can come with this kind of help. So I think that the ballot initiative is a monstrous and stupid project, which without any consideration for the woman's situation, takes away the right for her to make a decision for her own health care and for me to be able to help her.
And I know that women from out of Colorado also come to you. They're concerned about after 22 weeks. When can a woman be diagnosed with fetal anomaly to come to you? Is it before 22 weeks or is it after 22 weeks?
Well, it ranges from very early in the pregnancy. For example, they can do chorionic villi sampling and sometimes make a diagnosis very early in the pregnancy. There are radiographic tests that allow them to make a diagnosis of certain conditions at 12 or 13 or 14 weeks of the last period. But there are many conditions that may not be diagnosed until after 30 weeks. And some of these simply do not show up or they're not apparent earlier in the pregnancy. Sometimes the woman cannot get a diagnosis soon enough. We have cases where the woman has a diagnosis early in pregnancy. Her doctor withholds the diagnosis because the doctor does not want her to have an abortion. This is unethical, of course, but it's a common practice. And I think that the other thing is that the testing situation is very questionable because many physicians will do an amniocent or a diagnostic a study with their x-rays or ultrasound at 20 or 18 or 20 weeks, and they don't do any others. And so by the time the woman discovers that there is a catastrophic problem, she may be more than 30 weeks pregnant.
That's Dr. Warren Hearn, the founder and owner of the Boulder Abortion Clinic, speaking with KGNU's Miriam Schiff about Initiative 120, which will ask Colorado voters this November to ban abortions performed after the gestational age of the fetus reaches 22 weeks. Now, we'll hear an extended conversation with Dr. Hearn this Wednesday morning at 8:35, talking about not just Initiative 120, but similar legislation happening around the country. It is 8:23, you're listening to KGNU. Well, Global Green Grants Fund is based in Boulder, but it supports communities around the world, helping them protect their ways of life and giving them a say in the health of their communities, their food, their water and their resources. Earlier this year, they got a brand new CEO and president, Laura Garcia. I spoke with Laura about the work of Global Green Grants Fund, and particularly now during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Grassroots organizations are very underfunded, right? But there's a gender component in all of this, because obviously that affects also the ability or the access of funding that women environmentalists have. So they have even yet less money available and less financing available for their environmental actions. So we have recognized this in our work, and fortunately we have been doing more and more work to the point where almost 70% of our grant making money goes towards groups that are either led by women or that work with women's rights in the intersection with environmental rights. And this intersection is very important. What do I mean by this intersection? If we work in environmental activism without considering the patriarchal structures that eliminate the possibility of women to have a voice and to be recognized and to also play a part, not only as victims of climate change, but as change makers, we lose an amazing and a huge opportunity to make climate justice work even more impactful. If we don't recognize the important role that women's environmental justice leaders are doing at the grassroots level, they are resisting the advancement of extractive industries, for example, that are hurting our natural resources. They are the ones that are usually also organizing their own communities to understand how to make environmental choices based on self-determination of indigenous peoples, for example. So women are playing a hugely important role in the work for environmental justice around the world. And we definitely need to continue supporting them, but also to let the entire public know, and also the philanthropic sector know, about how important is it for us to continue providing more and more resources around the world for these women environmental justice leaders.
Obviously, COVID-19 has impacted all aspects of the life and all aspects of life, and it's impacted every corner of the globe. And I know that Global Green Grants is responding in this way. How have women, and particularly women working in environmental justice, how have they been specifically impacted by COVID-19?
So there's a lot of different impacts that are going on right now. Obviously, the health impact is huge for everybody. That also affects, by the way, the dynamism in which social movements behave and help build social change, the social change that we need in the world. For example, street activism has been hugely impacted, but there's other opportunities, like we have seen here in the United States with the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, that even though there are huge restrictions, we also see social movements become extremely resilient and be very dynamic and spontaneous. And that also helps continue building change, even in times of crisis like this one. But let me go back to the affectations and the different affectations or impacts that COVID-19 has had to the groups and the group of women and men environmental defenders around the world. There's definitely a health impact, like the one that we are all experiencing, but there's also a very important economic impact, because if when we look at the grassroots activists, most of them do not own their living from the financing that that funders provide them, because the financing is not enough for them to sustain their family. So usually their work, their activist work, is not the work that helps them sustain their livelihoods and their families. So they have secondary or they have other activities that help them provide the economy that the family needs to sustain themselves. And this has been hugely impacted. So one of the things that we are doing with a lot more focus, but we have always been working on it, is focusing on enhancing and financing agroecological practices and the local food production, not only activist families themselves, but communities as well. So a lot of our funding right now to respond to the COVID crisis is very much related actually to environmental justice and to our mission. Because one of the things that is very important for us to understand is that the pandemic, the solution to the pandemic and the recovery to the pandemic, is actually something that has been the voice of these environmental leaders before the COVID crisis hit. For example, we have consistently said that we need to modify our economic system and our system of food production to make sure that it becomes more sustainable, that it becomes less harming to the environment. These practices coincide and are very much related to the practices that we need to continue enhancing for a fast recovery of the pandemic's huge impact in food production around the world, food scarcity, and the economic recession that we're seeing and that we will continue to see.
That's Laura Garcia, who is the new president and CEO of the Boulder-based Global Green Grants Fund. Find out more about their work at greengrants.org.